Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Echo Entertainment's FY 2013 results call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star one on your telephone keypad. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, Thursday, the 22nd of August, 2013. I'd now like to hand the conference over to your first presenter for today, Mr. John Redmond, CEO of Echo Entertainment. Thank you, sir, and please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the call for the FY 2013 full year results. Sitting here with me is Matt Vecchio, the CFO of the group. I'll quickly provide a little bit of overview. Matt, after that, will run through the financials with everyone, and then we'll leave some time at the end for some Q&A. Real quickly, some FY 2013 overview. The statutory NPAT for the group was 83.5 million, up almost 98% on the PCP. Of course, prior period was impacted by higher significant items and a lower win rate. The normalized NPAT for the year would be approximately 127 million. Statutory EBITDA for the group up about almost 26% on PCP to about 335 million, with growth from The Star offset by some weakness with the Queensland properties. Normalized EBITDA of 391.4 million after applying our updated normalization rates. Matt will touch base on our normalization process and what we're doing with updating that. The EBITDA under prior normalization rates would have been about 399 million for FY 2013, or up 3.3% on the PCP on a like-for-like basis. We had some solid growth here at The Star on a normalized basis, up about 12.7%, driven by a completed expansion. Again, the table area, both the main gaming floor and the PGRs combined, were up about 3.6%. On a normalized basis, our VIP rebate business was up approximately 32%, and non-gaming revenue was up approximately 25%. The Queensland properties were negatively impacted by soft consumer sentiment, with normalized revenue down approximately 1.7% on a PCP, and normalized EBITDA, excluding significant items, down approximately 6.8%. The strong performance, of course, in the VIP business, with record front money and great collection experience. Of course, good collection experience is reflective of making the proper credit decisions up front. As you see, our front money is up approximately 35%. At the same time, with that type of volume, our receivables are down approximately 42% on the year. The cost optimization program implemented, of course, it started in April of 2012, flowed through an estimated 38 million reduction in FY 2013, and the program is on track to produce incremental savings in excess of 30 million in FY 2014. Real quick, looking at some of the major drivers over the course of the year. The revenue at The Star, the growth we chatted about, is up about 140 million. The gaming taxes and expenses, of course, up about 82 million. Some of that is due to the 1% increase, which accounts for about 7 million. When you look at the OpEx growth of 42 million at The Star, some of that relates to, of course, the new facilities that came on during the year, as well as the provision change, what we'll talk about a little bit later in the call, which accounts for about 6 million or thereabout. Of course, the IRB volume increases that I mentioned, where our front money was up significantly. Some of that, of course, flows through in this area. Again, a strong FY 2013 results. Talk about some key achievements in the year. I think one of the things to point out, when I first started back in January 18th, the first call I participated on, I mentioned that there was some areas that we were going to focus on quickly and early. Two of those, of course, were cost optimization and revenue enhancement. The cost optimization, as we discussed, would be something that would obviously happen much quicker, revenue enhancement would take a little bit longer to come about because there's always longer terms programs associated with that, like the Absolute Rewards revamp we did. So those are everything I chatted about and mentioned that we would do, we did. The cost optimization that we chatted about, of course, largely completed, with the savings in excess of $60 million between what was previously announced and what was announced at that time. And again, an incremental $30 million of cost reduction we expect in FY14 relative to FY13. As you can see, we've had strong momentum in our VEIP business I mentioned, both revenue and collections, which we spoke about. And I think one of the things that you'll find that we've added to our disclosures is relates to our receivables and our provisioning. I think you'll find that useful in trying to understand the quality of our earnings, not only today, but going forward, of course. When you look at that VIP business, again, we're very proud of the fact that front money was up 35% to over, and of course, gross revenue up almost 43% to $387 million. Normalized gross revenue is up approximately 27% to $442 million. We had a win rate in line with what our historical average is, around 1.62%. The turns were slightly down to 11.4, below our historic average of 13 times, which is the average we've experienced, of course, over the last 5 years. And again, Matt will talk about the whole issue regarding normalization a little bit later in the call. Our bad and doubtful debt expense for the year, $18 million. And again, as I mentioned before, that's up about $6 million, and not up $6 million. About $6 million of that relates to a little bit more conservative approach we've taken with our receivables in the year and, of course, going forward as well. So that accounts for an extra $6 million. And, again, there's a little bit better disclosure in that regard on the schedule we've attached. We're now provisioned around 54% of our total overdue credit at June 30. And, of course, our net trade receivables, I mentioned before, down 43%. Our VIP business has been very constant and consistent in its growth on a over the last 5 years from 2009, we had a CAGR of 20%. And of course, that would be 28% on a normalized basis during that same time frame. VIP business for the rest of this year, again, we look forward to the strong momentum that we saw in 13 continuing to 14, and we're happy about what's going on in the VIP space. And I'm sure when you look at the numbers, that speaks to that very loudly. When you look at some of our key priorities going forward, it's all about driving the top line now in FY14. We're pretty much done with the optimization program on a significant basis. There's always going to be opportunities, but I don't think you're going to see us calling out any items going forward. I think for the most part, we've identified everything that's significant, and what you'll see going forward will be much more modest. So it's all about driving the top line. It's all about focusing on our Absolute Rewards program going forward. Our loyalty program, of course, we launched for the most part on June 1st, a couple months ago. Too early to provide any great amount of detail on that. But in the short term, we're happy with what's going on there and very excited about the opportunity going forward. When you look at the Queensland market, we are putting KCMS in that market as well as a brand new product. We have been fortunate enough to have some relaxation of the requirements there, which have allowed us to put non-QCOM a product in that market as well as TITO, ticket in, ticket out technology. We expect by the end of this calendar year to be about 50% TITO, and probably within the first quarter of the subsequent calendar year, we would be a completely installed TITO environment. So very excited about that. We're looking at that to give us some momentum in our slot and electronic machine growth going forward there. Also, sticking with Queensland, we're looking to do an FY14, of course, is to get some resolution for all of Southeast Queensland, trying to figure out what to do in that marketplace with both the Jupiter's facility on the Gold Coast as well as Brisbane. We've had great conversations with the government there. We believe, as I think most people do, that there should be one casino in that precinct. And once we have resolution of that particular issue, it allows us, of course, to move forward with what we want to do at Jupiter's. In both cases, we're spending time developing what needs to be developed in those markets. That includes a relocation of our gaming operations from the Treasury, the existing Treasury Casino, to a new facility, and designing what that facility could become, as well as identifying what we want to do with redoing the Jupiter's facility. And, of course, we will also be spending time this year dealing with what we want to do with this particular property here at the Star to address what the environment's going to be here post-2019. I think when you look at the whole Treasury Brisbane relocation, I think timing-wise, it's still somewhat of a moving target, but our expectation is there would probably be some sort of a process that would be identified, EOI, RFP, or something like that. Probably before the end of the calendar year, we're expecting that to probably be in the October timeframe. And that would, of course, be in a process that we would participate in. And I think some of the early indication is there would be some resolution on a one casino environment prior to that EOI or RFP process getting started. A quick trading update before I turn this over to Matt to go through some financials. The actual revenue for the first 7 weeks is up 6.8%, 9.6% on a normalized basis. Strong growth, of course, continues in our VIP revenue side of the business with some softer performance in the domestic business. When you look at the prior year, the PCP, some of the revenue that, of course, I've explained in the past was driven by some inefficient marketing. So the comparable is a little bit kind of not an apples-to-apples comparison, if you will. But when we have a flat growth with the inefficient marketing that took place in the past, the flow-through is what you're really going to start to see going forward. Again, our cost optimization program are starting to flow through in the early part of 14. We're very excited about the results we're getting there. As we said, we would have a lot of discipline around that to make sure that what we achieved would be maintained not only in 14 but years out. But one of the things to point out as part of that cost optimization, we wanted to set the business up for a long period of time going forward with redoing our structure. And that also included addressing the EBA agreements that we have here at the Star that came up during the year, as well as Brisbane going forward. We have concluded both of those. There's some information on that with respect to the Star included in the deck that you've been provided. But I think when you look at that, you'll see that the most significant expense that we have, we've been able to really put some collars around that and set the business up going forward nicely. And on that note, I'll turn it over to Matt to go through some of the financials for you.
Thank you, John. If I can ask you to turn to page 18. 18 summarizes the group financials. Just going from the top on the left-hand side of the schedule, we report gross revenue growth of 9.3%. As John pointed out, that's really driven by IRB. Domestic revenue, excluding IRB, was up 3.3%. And you've got the details of the makeup on the revenue lines in the appendix. This translates to a smaller growth in the variable contribution line of 7%. That's a mix issue, you know, more IRB, more non-gaming growth than core gaming growth, as well as the fact that in 2012, we had the last year of tax increases of the base rate at Star. Operating expenditures all up for the year were up 5%. We reported OPEX growth of 6.8% at the half, so you're starting to see some of the cost growth to slow. despite the additional capacity that's been coming on stream. That gives us an EBITDA of growth of 12.1% on actuals and 1.4% on a normalization basis. D&A is up, largely because of Project Star, as well as some other investments that we've been making in Queensland. Net interest down from last year by 15.4% to $79.4 million. We had guided the market to about $85 million previously. The reason why it's lower is we've got slightly lower base rates. Not much of that comes through because we are largely hedged, but we've got a slightly higher level of capitalized interest, $2 million extra more than we had anticipated. And we've drawn down less money than we had planned because we held back on the CapEx. Tax sits at $34.8 million for the year. That's a tax rate of 23.6%. That's, again, unusually high because of a number of adjustments that we put through to the tax rate, notionally sort of R&D, as well as the settlement with the tax office around the 2007 exclusivity payment with the New South Wales government. That's all settled now, and going forward, we should anticipate a tax rate of about 30%. That gives us an actual NPAT of $112.7 million before significant items. That's down 15.5% on a normalization basis, but as John said, that's not strictly comparable to last year. Let me now focus on three specific aspects that really impact these results. That's the cost optimization, significant items, and normalization. Over the page on page 19, you see the progress of the cost reduction program. And as John said, the cost has been a focus for us in the second half. And we're pleased to report that the bulk of the cost work is now behind us. Over 88% of all the work was done by balance date. There's some additional work that has happened since. Whatever is happening this year is largely provided for, and to the extent that it isn't, we expect to take that just through the normal expense line rather than showing additional significant items for that. That's at least the intention. The chart that you've got below gives a little bit of a sense or hopes to illustrate that, you know, that the cost is coming out, and it picks up essentially the same buckets that we showed at the half. So starting from a 2012 second half run rate of $822 million, which excludes the volatile bad debt provisioning, you know, all things being equal, given volume growth and so on, we should have expected to get to $889 million of expenses in 2013. We arrived at $851 million, excluding bad debt provisioning, because we've taken about $11 million cost out through redundancies, additional $12 million through staffing, and $50 million through procurement and other types of savings. So that that means that we're already booking over $30 million of savings in 2013. If you now look at 2014, we've got a cost base of $869 million. That's a sort of basic run rate. If you allow for 2% inflation, that's lower than we would have in the past because, as John said, we've been able to lock away the EBA. If you allow for 2% inflation, the impact of new facilities and the volume growth that we have budgeted for, as well as the incremental rental cost that's going to be levied on us in Brisbane, you know, you get to a number that should have been north of $930 million. But we are comfortable that we will bring that number in below 900. So that's the other $30 million of cost savings that are coming through. That's all I really wanted to say on the cost. Over the page, I'll turn to the second item, which is later, which is the significant items. We have guided the market to about $25 million of significant items. We're now showing 38. Two major deviations. One is we wrote off all the development expenses related to the unsolicited proposal. And secondly, we were able, as John said, to lock in a deal with the employees here at the Star that are under the EBA that gives us a more a flatter expense growth in the future. So what's behind that is really, you know, we 170 cost base for staff under the EBA at Star is $175 million. And what's been hurting us in the past is the compounding effect of 3 to 4% increases year after year. By 2013 now, we arrived at a cost base that was in an hourly rate that was essentially out of the market and was making it very difficult for us to keep certain facilities open. With the new arrangement now, we're bringing their cost growth forward. We're bringing the rates closer to the market rates, and we're saving ourselves a reasonable amount of money going forward. So that's been a positive development, and we are doing similar things in the other properties. The third topic I wanted to touch on is just the normalization. You know that the way we normalize our results is that we take front money, we multiply it by the turns that we've experienced in over the last 5 years, and then look at the win rate over the last 5 years to arrive at a normalized revenue. At the beginning of this year, the five-year average stood at 14 times turns and 1.6% win rate. Including the 2013 results, that reduces to 13 times turns and a win rate of 1.62%. The schedule on the right-hand side of page 21 shows you what the impact is. Had we applied last year's normalization, we would have reported an EBITDA, a normalized EBITDA of 398.6. Under the new reduced normalization, that comes down to $391.4 million. Going forward for this financial year, we're now be applying the new five-year averages of 13 times turns and 1.62%. I should say, while it's a short, very brief period of time, in the first 7 weeks of trading, you know, the win rate and the turns have sort of returned to stronger levels that we've experienced in the past again. So it is a bit of a volatile issue. And that sort of makes us think about the way we do normalize. While we, you know, we believe that, you know, we have the most scientific way of normalizing, that issue was particularly important for us, I think, while the VIP business was quite small and very lumpy in terms of its returns. Now that the business is expanding and becoming more predictable, we'll be reviewing our normalization methodology in the course of the year, and we expect to move to a methodology that may be less precise but more in line with what other market participants expect to do. So those are the three sort of key items on the expenses. Let me now turn to the balance sheet and on page number 22. I want to call out a couple of things. On the asset side, cash and cash equivalents have come down. We've used cash to repay bank debt. You'll see that in there. Trade and other receivables have come down substantially from $322 million last year to $84 this year. Two aspects to that. On one hand, you may recall last year we were in the middle of a capital raise and we had not yet received the retail component. That was then subsequently received, and we've used the cash that we then received to repay debt. So that's reduced the receivables substantially. Most pleasingly, though, the trade receivables that relate to the IRB business have also come down quite substantially. And you see that in note 16 in the accounts, I think, where last year we had trade receivables of $130 million that relate to the IRB business. This year we're showing $74 million. So it's a significant improvement. Further down, the non-current assets are largely unchanged. On the liability side, you see that we have no current liabilities, interest-bearing liabilities. So that really reflects the fact that we have restructured our borrowings and pushed them up a little bit. And then the non-current liabilities, that essentially represents now all our borrowings. That's pretty much, so you see it's a pretty strong balance sheet the way it presents right now. Over the page 23 then on CapEx. In 2011, we had CapEx of $400 million. In 2012, it was 346. This year was 155. So basically, Project Star is over, and we're now looking at an underlying replacement CapEx rate of about $100 million per year. For 2014, we anticipate CapEx of about $150 to $160 million. The difference between the replacement CapEx and the number that we're targeting is really growth CapEx. Particularly in Queensland, that's going to be around introducing ticket in, ticket out, all the new machines that John has referenced, the new casino management system, as well as some additional food and beverage facilities across the casinos. So that growth CapEx should drive additional earnings. But it obviously means that as the CapEx is coming off, the cash generation strengthens quite nicely. That takes me to the last point I wanted to touch on page 24, which is our funding. As I said earlier, we now have restructured our banking facilities. We have no current facilities. The next repayment date is in 2016. Our total net debt is $707 million at balance date. That gives us less than 2x gearing, which is very comfortable. One thing that is the interest for us is relatively high, or it's actually surprisingly high probably, and the reason for that is set out on the right-hand side. You see there that the cost of the hedges that we inherited essentially through the demerger when we picked up some of these facilities is exceptionally high. You may recall that at demerger there was a sort of a sense that the world was going to turn around. We're potentially expecting inflation, and so we entered into very long-term hedges that are now very expensive as the economy has gone the other way. And we estimate that in 2013, we carried about $26 million of extra interest in our interest line relative to the underlying cash expense. Good news is that that interest starts to roll off from 2004. Those hedges start to roll off from 2014. But it's not a situation we enjoy, and it's something that we'll be working on this year to see whether we can find a better solution for us to help us drive the bottom line. This concludes my observations, and with that, I'd like to hand back to John for Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matt. Operator, I think maybe we'll go ahead at this point in time and turn it over for Q&A.
Of course. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad and then wait for your name to be announced. And your first question comes from the line of Matt Ryan of JP Morgan. Please ask your question.
Hi, guys. I just had a couple of questions on the PGR business. Can you talk about what the $15.8 million reclassification to PGR from VIP represents?
That's the domestic rebate business we do that is reclassified. That's what that line item refers to. So that's the business that's outside of international that's done domestically.
Right. So, I mean, it looks like there's a difference between your normalized and actual results there. I think it says that the domestic rebate business is not normalized in FY13. Is there a reason why you've done that for 1 year and not the other?
Well, it's the only reason is, let me put it this way. We think the 2013 treatment is probably more accurate, because fundamentally it's the same player, it's just under a different tax arrangement.
Right. Okay, so without the reclassification, how do you think the business went?
The win rate was not a material swinger for us. But it should be fair to say that we are not happy with the performance of the private gaming room overall. That's a big opportunity for us for the next couple of years.
One of the things I'd mentioned previously is that's an area that we know that we have to invest in from a bricks and mortar standpoint. So that's something that we're working on during the course of this year, what we will do up in that area.
Okay. So going forward, do you plan to normalize that business for win rate or anything?
No.
Again, it's, when you look at it in a grand scheme of things, it's not significant.
Sure. I'm more referring to the $15.8 million that's gone into the business. It seems like it's roughly $4 million that's gone into the FY12 adjustment and $15.8 into the 13.
That's just the business is starting to grow, which is why you're seeing the number increase in 13. But we expect good things and good growth in that part of our business. But again, when you're looking at PGR in total, it's not significant, although we expect it to continue to grow.
Okay. And then just your comments, Matt, about the win rate methodology. I guess what you're alluding to in your review that you'll be going through this year is to come in line with other casino companies, which you sort of flagged. I'd expect that probably the most liquid VIP baccarat market in the world being Macau is a pretty good reference point. In Macau, they don't adjust for turnover, but they obviously have a higher win rate than some of the other operators in Australia. Their VIP win rates up there range from sort of 2.7 to 3. So, is that a sort of fair assumption on the sort of review that you'll be taking and the sort of the process that you'll be adopting going forward?
Look, I don't want to commit right now to what win rate we might want to adopt and what methodology. But you know, the reality is, you know, while we think, you know, scientifically we've got the right answer, it's becoming very confusing and difficult to explain to everybody around us. Mm-hmm. And as we look at the win rates, the reality is the win rate is what it is over the last 5 years. We measure it in both turns and win rates. They are what they are. So we think that looking at our own historical performance, particularly now that the business is becoming of a material size and doesn't really change dramatically, is the right way of doing it. Whether we will continue to use turns as a basis to normalize or just take actual terms, that's something that we want to look at.
Sure, but I mean, if you're moving to a more liquid pool of VIP play at your properties in Australia, I assume that you'll be moving closer to what the more liquid markets overseas are, which in Aussie language would be roughly 1.425.
But again, you know, you gotta understand, you can't use a win rate for normalizing that is completely different from what we experience from an actual standpoint. So over the time frame that you can see in the schedule we provided, over a long period of time, we're experiencing a win rate that approximates 1.62. So for us to assume a win rate that's significantly lower than that would make no sense. The one part that we are taking a look at is the area that deals with turns. So that's where we're starting to see, as the business grows, as our base of business is getting larger, we're going to take a look and see whether or not there is rationale for simplifying the determination or the calculation of normalized win. But it will not involve using a win rate that's lower than what our historical win rate has been and that we currently are experiencing.
Sure, but I mean, is there a reason why your property should differ in win rate to any other properties playing the same game?
I have no idea. I don't know enough about how they calculate at Macau. I don't work there, but I do know that our win rate is reflective, obviously, of what we experience. So I can't comment on their calculation. I don't know. But it makes no sense for us to use a rate that's different than what we experience.
Okay, sure. And just one last one. Just slots in Queensland, can you just talk about the timing for the upside in the changes that you're making out there?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we began the implementation August 19th. We expect to be 50% implemented, if you will, with Tito by the end of the calendar year. So obviously the upside from that will start to accelerate towards the end of the calendar year and into the next year, when we expect to be fully implemented probably by the end of the first quarter of the subsequent calendar year.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Mark Wilson of Deutsche Bank. Please ask your question.
Thanks very much, John. I was just wondering whether you could elaborate on performance of the domestic businesses in the first 7 weeks, you know, a little bit more detail about Sydney compared to Queensland and machines fee tables.
Well, I think we don't want to provide really any more detail on what you see there, because it would be a mistake to extrapolate off of 7 weeks. So I think what we've given is just a good indication of what's happening in the business, realizing that it's extremely short-term and not necessarily represents what's going to happen over a course of a year. Having said that, the encouraging part about that is that things are not deteriorating, at least in the 7 weeks. And the expense optimization that we have chatted about here is flowing through. So on both fronts, we're happy with what's going on there. Obviously, we're spending a lot of time now driving the top line, so that's where the area of focus is and will be going forward. But I think, as you can see, the 7 weeks are good, but I think to provide any more detail would be misleading at best.
Right. And the new system in Queensland, has that been rolled out as of yet?
The new system, I'm assuming you're talking about KCMS?
Yes.
The casino management, yes. That was, we installed August 19th. And really, it's been an install that's gone beautifully. We haven't had any problems.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from a line of Adam Alexander of Goldman Sachs. Please ask your question.
Good morning, guys. Just a couple of questions. First one, it seems to me the biggest delta next year is improving the slot performance at the Star. Firstly, how much impact was there from the transition through to the new absolute reward system? And then secondly, how long do you give the new rewards program to get traction with consumers?
I think it's difficult with any degree of accuracy to calculate an impact due to a changeover from one system to another. I think it was widely understood that when you change out a system, there's a period of time it takes to get awareness and get traction. So we're going through that time frame or that period right now. We started to pull back on a lot of the inefficient marketing that was going on, if you will, in the second half of the year. And we are happy with the rollout of Absolute Rewards. Now it's a matter of building on the awareness, and that is something that always takes a bit of time. So I can't commit to a time frame, but with the passage of time, clearly, we understand more about it. We understand more about the impact, and our customers become more aware of the benefits. So I would hope by our shareholder meeting, for instance, we would have a lot more color. We would expect to have a lot more color about the performance of our Absolute Rewards. The early indication from and some of the feedback we're getting has been extremely positive. But again, I don't want to mislead in any regard at this early stage. I think it's best that we get a little bit more information, a little bit more performance out of that before we attempt to comment.
Right, thanks. Just on the Star VIP, I mean, you're getting continue to get very strong growth there. I'm just wondering, what are the main drivers? Is it new customers or repeat customers sort of spending more? And what sort of capacity levels do you think you're running at now, if you can sort of estimate that?
Well, it's a combination of both. Fortunately, we're getting a new and repeat visitation. I think both speak to the quality level of the offering and the level of service that's being provided to our customers. We are not capacity constrained at this point in time, nor do we see that being a problem in the short to medium term. We are experiencing strong growth. Just to give you an idea, July historically is one of our, if not our slowest month from an IRV standpoint in each of the last several years. That was not the case in this July. It happened to be one of our strongest. So the fact that we're starting to see the play more spread out and not concentrated around the traditional periods that one would expect it, like Chinese New Year's, that's where we're comfortable about not having capacity problems, because we are seeing that play spread out much more ratably throughout. So I think it's safe to assume we're still going to see high demand during the historical high demand time frame. But the good thing is we're seeing very strong play during those non-traditional high-demand time frames.
And I mean, if I can just add one thing, the one major shift, and you see that coming through a little bit in the commission rates, is we've had a bigger share of junkets business this year. So 2013, the big junkets that we work with bought more custom, and, you know, that pushed up the average commission rate and, you know, changed the mix of customers a little bit.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Adam.
And your next question comes from a line of Michael Goldsman of Citi. Please ask your question.
Hi, guys. I've got two questions. Firstly, around your costs of the $38 million bucks. How much is related to Star?
About two-thirds of that relates to Star.
Okay.
So 38, just go, you're talking about the 38 was the significant items or the cost reduction?
It's really a 30.
Sorry, the cost reduction.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, let's call it 30 because we've put some, you know, we reinvested in some functions as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we right now internally we sort of look at having captured about $30 million net of the reinvestment, and of that, 2/3 relates to staff.
Okay, right. And the 2% guidance that you gave before, that's purely the inflation target that you're talking about?
I just wanted to give you a round number. So if you're trying to say, look, what should you, you know, in a steady state basis, what would you expect? Normally, we would have expected a higher escalation of costs because our EBAs in the past have been running at north of 3%. You know, because we've done the deal here at Star and just us since the balance date, also a comparable deal in Queensland, you know, our underlying cost base will grow at a lower rate. And so we've taken that down from 3 to 2.
Okay. And I assume your new facility costs will be a lot lower than what they were on that chart for this year, the $16 million?
Yes.
Okay. So arguably, I mean, when I put all that together, arguably a $900 million target should be pretty easy for you guys to get. It seems very conservative.
No, it sounds like some people, I mean, negotiate targets here, but... Look, you know, you have to be realistic about, you know, the forecast, you know, to the extent, we said it quite clearly, this is the number we're targeting. The big swing factor there is the volume, right? And volume really relates to tables. So, you know, we anticipate a certain level of growth, which I'm not going to tell you, a reasonable level of growth. And, you know, if that doesn't come through, we need to take more cost out. And if we have more growth, particularly in tables and food and beverage, then, you know, we'll put extra cost in to feed that business.
You know, I think the takeaway here at the end of the day is we feel comfortable enough given what we have done, what we've communicated, and the discipline and structure we've put around our cost program to communicate an outside number. And I think that's the real takeaway, is that we are comfortable because of what we have done and that discipline that we can do that.
Okay. Well, thanks. John, my second question is more targeted to you. I guess I'm a bit confused about what Absolute Rewards is actually going to bring to you. I mean, is the focus of this to generate new visitation or to increase the spend from the existing patrons?
It's both. So when you look at, and I always use airlines as an example because they're something all of us have participated in and understand. So you join a program because of its benefits, and you fly more frequently because of the accelerating benefits as you fly more. So if you look at that and apply that analogy simplistically against ours, that's what we're really attempting to do, because in this space, this gaming space, you drive revenue really through one of two ways, either through more people or people playing longer. So this particular program has been designed to be able to do both, to attract more and to get the existing people to play longer.
All right. Well, how are you structuring it to generate more people, though?
Well, it's the offering. So if you look in the past, we had the way we would attract people was by basically saying, I'll just oversimplify, if you sign up, you don't have to pay for parking. Or if you sign up, we'll give you free $100 in slot play. You know, there was always something of value that we gave up in order to have you sign up. Now, when a customer looks at the program, it's based on the attractiveness of the program as opposed to us giving something away. So if someone now looks at the program and says, wow, I'm entitled to a 20% discount every time I go to a food or beverage outlet or I stay in the hotel, that's pretty compelling. I would like to be a customer. Or we also, people participate on their non-gaming spend in addition to gaming spend. So the loyalty basically has been designed to be attractive enough to attract anybody who looks at anything we have in this building as a form of entertainment. So you're being rewarded on food and beverage and hotel spend as well as gaming spend, and that's what helps drive that loyalty factor for people to come here and come here frequently.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
And your next question comes from the line of Sasha Kreen of CLSA. Please ask your question.
Good morning, guys. I've just got a question on the strong numbers in your VIP business. You clearly appear to be taking share in Australia and regionally. Can you give us a feel for the commission rates that you're paying out on the VIP business at the moment and whether you've been able to pull those back at all to improve margins in that business?
Sure. I think it's important to point out that that our commission rates arguably are flat to down. And I think, so we're not driving market share through increasing our commission rates. I think when you look at the business over time, say several years ago, Star had approximately 20% market share. That market share now is 30. And so I think that speaks to what we are doing here, both in terms of what's been done with the asset base, the investment in private gaming rooms, suites, aircraft, and whatnot, as well as what I said, the wonderful job that our marketing teams do and our employees do here in delivering on the service that these guests expect. So we are very excited about this business going forward, and we think we have a good handle on it. And I think even when you look at the collection side of it now, as Matt spoke to a little bit as well, I think everything is operating by design. And we're very excited about the infrastructure we've put in across the board in that particular space to drive more business, to drive more profitable business, and it's not through marketing programs that would impact margin.
Okay, thanks. And just also on VIP, can you give us a feel for the splits between direct versus junket play and how that's changed, I guess, over the last couple of years?
Look, it's always fluctuated a little bit, but we've seen a long-term drift more towards VIP, towards junkets. Last year, we were at, I want to say, 65%. This year, we're about 10 percentage points higher.
Okay, and just a final question from me. Both the New South Wales and Queensland governments have alluded towards tax increases in some form for both properties. So in New South Wales, they talked about a casino supervisory levy. I think Queensland in its budget papers last year talked about an extra $8 million contribution but didn't specify where it was coming from. Are you able to give any guidance or colour on what might be happening there and whether you're going to have any impact in FY14?
On the Queensland side, in our cost forecast, we've allowed for $8 million. Technically, that will come through as rent increase for Treasury, but it's really the nature of it is the gaming tax increase that you referenced. On the New South Wales side, you know, we've had communication from the government that says that they want to recoup some of the supervisory costs. The total cost of that department is around about $8 million, and we will have to bear our share of that. I'm not sure that we have entirely landed on what we think the right share of that activity is, but that will also come through this financial year. So Queensland is entirely covered. New South Wales will have to advise when we find out.
I think the other thing we're hoping in that regard is the $8 million Matt references is due to the current regulatory scheme and environment and is driven by the volume of transactions given that environment. So I think one of the things that that everyone seems to be open to is having a conversation as to possibly how that environment could be streamlined to reduce the volumes of transactions and then hopefully the overall expense. But again, that's early on in the conversation, but there seems to be a willingness to have that conversation.
Okay, thanks, John. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Mark Bryan of Merrill Lynch. Please ask your question.
Yeah, morning, John. Morning, Matt. Just one question from me, if I may. Just around the strategic outlook for Star, in the run-up to the Barangaroo decision, you signaled, obviously, to shareholders in the market that you'd invest north of $1 billion in the property. What direction do you take now the next 5 years? Do you cut back? Do you try and drive free cash flow? You've got basically 5 years to try and shore up the business. Can you just give us a bit more color as to what you're thinking from a strategic perspective there? Thank you.
Sure. I think we've made public comment already that the proposal that was made as part of the unsolicited proposal process of $1.4 billion, I mean, that we won't do. Beyond that, there is things that we've always acknowledged we need to do here, regardless of what would have happened in this environment. By that, I mean there's the deferred maintenance type CapEx spend that one needs to make, like keeping your rooms relevant and keeping your restaurants relevant, or adding additional restaurant capacity to address the demands of our customers. So those are things that were, in some cases, part of that $1.4 billion and things that we need to do anyway. So we're continuing to look at that. We are going to be, at some point in time in the future, sometime this year, we'll be making some further comments about what I would call deferred maintenance spend like that I've talked about, whether it be restaurants or rooms. So we'll provide a little bit more color in that regard. When it comes to what we may do from a strategic standpoint to deal with a competitive environment, we are having conversations about that internally. We have developed some concepts and ideas as to what we want to do going forward, but for obvious reasons, those are plans we won't communicate. So we will communicate everything that we will be doing to keep the property relevant, like I mentioned, but the programs or the expenditure that would be targeted to what we would call the strategic spend to address the competitive environment going forward, that's something we won't comment on in the short term.
Thanks, John. And so that, Matt, the 150, sorry, 140 to 150 CapEx, that includes some of those projects that John's referring to, is it, for later this year? I'm a little bit surprised, I guess, that it's at 140, 150 when you had 92 excluding Star and Icon.
That includes, in particular, the biggest chunk of that is the Star and Icon, the equivalent number was 160. And so the underlying business as usual expense is about $90 to $100 million. Mm-hmm. The reason why this year it's going to be higher is essentially the casino management system rollout into the Queensland properties. That then triggers the opportunity to move to non-QCOM machines. So, you know, you might have seen that the DNA in Queensland has bumped up. That's partly got to do with the fact that we've accelerated the write-off on some of the equipment because we're going to refresh a lot of the equipment, upgrade the machines to ticket in, ticket out machines. That's going to, you know, give rise, hopefully, in the final quarter of this financial year to some significant earnings growth from slots in Queensland and turn around the trend of the last couple of years. But that's the focus of the CapEx. And then the, you know, room refresh, you know, a couple of extra restaurants and stuff like that, that's all covered.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
And your next question comes from a line of Sam Theodore of UBS. Please ask your question.
Thanks. Hey, guys. I'm just wondering, John, you've obviously taken a different approach to some of the provisioning around your receivables in terms of now adding a sort of age-based approach. Just wondering if you could explain to us the rationale around that and then maybe the reduction you saw in the receivables, if that was driven by anything specifically?
Good question, Sam. I think when you look at the business, it's obviously becoming a much more significant part of our business, the VIP. And as a result, it makes sense that we take a step back and look at it and make sure that from our shareholder perspective as well as all of you folks, that the amount of disclosure we have in that area is proper and that the quality of our earnings is evident to all, because we don't want, as our business starts to accelerate there, we don't want people to be questioning whether or not those or the qualitative aspect of our earnings. So I think by being a little bit more conservative on looking at our provisioning and providing additional disclosure, we are hoping to address both those points. And I think the reduction that you see in our receivables is really a reflection of the process that's put in place here, dealing with the type of credit we're extending, who we're extending it to, and what the expectations are around the repayment relating to that. So I think overall the team has done a very good job in this space. As you can see, it's gotten better and better over the years as we as a company get better, as we add more and more talent. So I think we're very comfortable with where we stand. I think when you look at any company in this particular space, we probably arguably provide better disclosure than anyone. I would welcome others to follow suit. But I think the expectation should be to do what we do in this important and volatile space to provide that disclosure, which is what we're doing going forward.
Sam, if I can just add two more aspects. One is the reason for the age-based provisioning and the levels at which we're setting basically goes back to some analysis that we've done over the portfolio of our collections over the last 4 years. And that shows that early collections is all, you know, is the safest way to go. And if it's, you know, even if it's a good credit, if it takes a long time to collect, you know, the risk goes up dramatically. And so we decided to just, you know, because the book of debtors is not a long list, it's not a big portfolio, it's just a few big names, we thought that we decided it was more prudent to overlay the specific provisioning with that age-based provisioning and set the levels at a point that aligns with the analysis of our historical collection rates. That's number one. Number two is with the shift to more junker business, you know, we are experiencing more rapid collection because most of our junkers are on, you know, essentially monthly clearance cycles, and so all the outstandings get cleared every month, and so that's beneficial for our cash collection ratio. You would have seen that in the back we've got a page where we show that, you know, this year our cash conversion is north of 100% because we've been able to collect a lot of the outstandings from prior years.
Okay, thank you. The other question I've got is just on the domestic business, particularly slots. We've seen, you know, weakness around the country really in the last 6 to 12 months. John, I guess I'm wondering just your take on what's going on in slots, and obviously I think particularly at Star, it's not it wouldn't be a product issue. It's obviously a marketing issue, hence the relaunch of the loyalty program. Is that the way of addressing whatever market weakness we're seeing?
Well, I think there's a combination of things here, Sam. I think, one, when I look at slots, I look at it really as electronic gaming overall, because there is arguably some play that's shifted from a slot product, as you call it here, and to a multi-terminal gaming product, just like I think as you see some people shifting or looking at a MTGM as being an introductory product to becoming a table game player, if you will. So I think some of when you look at slots in a vacuum and exclude that, I think that's where some of the issue is. Having said that, there is also no doubt that there is a softening environment here from a consumer sentiment standpoint. And I think when you have an environment like that, it becomes even more important to have a very compelling rewards program. So as people over time start to reduce their frequency and or spend, you want them to concentrate their play in a program that they find provides the greatest value. So that's why one of the many benefits that we get by having a program like this is being able to achieve that result. So we're improving our analytics in that particular space so we can get better to make sure that we can consolidate people's play over time here at this property and, of course, our Queensland properties as well. And I think that helps out in a market that has a softening consumer spend associated with it.
Thanks. And just one last thing for me. You talked about the inefficient marketing in the PCP with the old player loyalty program. And Matt's given very specific guidance around operating costs, which is obviously very helpful for us. But given the sort of revenue numbers you've talked about, should we also then extrapolate that sort of growth, albeit it's only sort of 1.5 months, is what's being experienced at the EBITDA line as well?
Yeah, I think again, it's really early to tell, but I think the in the past, if because of that inefficient spend, we were generating top line with no bottom line, and arguably in some cases probably negative bottom line because all the labor associated with it. I think because of that, if you pull all that out and you still are flat, you can make the argument that you've had growth, because just to be flat, your business volumes have to go up, and of course the margin on staying flat is much stronger. So we're of course hoping to grow over the prior year, but if we stay flat, you're going to see our margin growth be significantly higher, and as a result, the EBITDA performance of the properties will be significantly stronger than what it has been. And that's what we're excited about, and that's what we expected and we saw happen in July and going into August. And it's very encouraging trend that was expected because of what we've done.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad and then wait for your name to be announced.
I think, operator, maybe we'll take one or two more calls and then we'll end the call.
Thank you. And your next question comes from the line of Tony Senna of Selector Funds. Please ask your question.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking the call. Look, just a couple of questions. Perhaps the first to John, if you don't mind. Last year in the conference call, I asked a question regarding the returns that you could generate from the Star, and specifically on the EBITDA, because it was previously mentioned that a number in 2014 could be in the order of $340 million has been the aim. And if you look at the normalized earnings for this year for the Star, it came in at $260 million. Would you be prepared just to make a comment as to that target that was set some time ago? And I appreciate things have obviously changed in the meantime.
I think the target is achievable. I think the comment that I and others have made is that, I mean, obviously this property arguably lost a year given the lack of focus because of everything that was going on. I think over the last 6 months, call it the second half of the year, we've gone through a lot of transition and providing the structure for continued and sustainable success going forward. So that's what we are extremely excited about. And of course, everything from EBA agreements to cost optimization to everything else, we've set the stage, if you will, to be able to drive that bottom line that everyone expects. So I remain comfortable on being able to do $340 million here at the Star. I think July was a good start and a good indication to that opportunity and potential. So again, I think it's an achievable goal.
Thanks, John. Just with respect to the EBITDA margins and then also to the VIP business, as a proportion of your EBITDA, on my calculation, and it would suggest to me that obviously it's rising as a percentage of contribution, and it may be in the mid 20% range now that the VIP is contributing to your EBITDA. If that is correct, if I'm on the right track here, at what level or what point does it become an issue, or is it not an issue at this point, and you can see its contribution being more substantial, and from your point of view, you would be happy with that contribution?
Look, your analysis is correct. On our numbers, the business now contributes about 20% of earnings, and we, as we look into the future, we expect that percentage to grow. As John said, from a capacity point of view, we don't see any immediate need to dial that back. It's more probably raises questions in two areas. One is that, you know, the VIP business is not like your local market business, which is secure. I mean, we know over the last decade that, you know, come recession or not, come boom times or not, the local market business is always there, and it justifies the presence of a lot of infrastructure in your buildings, and it's essentially the foundation for funding your gearing. The VIP business is volatile. It's volatile in the win rate, and, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in the global marketplace and with visa restrictions and money flows. That could change or get into hiatus very quickly. So strategically, you don't want to become too dependent on that flow. We need to strike the right balance between those two considerations. you know, and you know, the side aspect of that is your balance sheet, because essentially with the volatility of that PIP business, you don't want to become too reliant on that earnings stream. So we're trying to strike the right balance. I don't think we're in the red zone at this point. As long as we can grow the business at the current rate with the current level of provisioning and with the current level of in the safety that we build into it, we're very comfortable with it.
Thanks, Matt.
One more question, operator. All done?
Great.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate everyone's time.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.